Anyway, good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? And I want to thank you all for inviting me up. I've had a nice stay here in New York City, and I hope that something I said tonight will be useful to you. I sincerely mean that. That's kind of what AA has been in my life. It's just a constant repetition of the same thing. I mean, that's what we all need, is the reassurance that this indeed is the answer. Because I don't know about you, but I've been in almost 28 years, and I still go wandering off and have my little troubles during the week and suddenly decide, maybe I just encountered a trouble that the steps don't apply to. I'm going to have to seek answers elsewhere, handle this little baby on my own, and all those sort of thoughts that enter in and take back control and all these things of being a human being. And I need sponsors. I need to go to the home group. I need to go somewhere where they're just going, this is it, this is it, and just repeating over and over the wonderful AA message. And I hope that's what I do tonight. Very briefly, I want to talk a lot about AA and not so much about myself and my story, because all our stories are basically the same if you think about it. We just got out there and got lost and got found. AA is the world's biggest lost and found department. And it's wonderful being found. And I like the analogy of lost. I mean, lost implies you don't have the foggiest idea what's going on, who you are, where you are. And that describes a lot of us and what life is. And none of it made any sense. It only made sense when I drank. Alcohol had the power for me to make sense out of things. And I look back on it, and I was like a battery in a car. You know, you buy a brand new battery and you don't put the water in, and it won't start the car. It's just, I don't care how expensive it is. And you have this wonderful thing that won't work. And that's what the way I was without alcohol. It just, I couldn't function right. There was something missing. And as soon as I put the alcohol in, it was like, there! Now I am complete. Now I have the courage and the perspective and the calmness and the energy and all the things that were missing to function as a human being. And I saw the world in a much different way through alcohol. That's what made me an alcoholic. I didn't realize that this wasn't happening to everybody. You know, I thought everybody had the same reaction to alcohol that I did. And I'm one of Clancy's big fans, and you'll hear me stealing material, but I always give him credit, from Clancy, when he talks about the fact that it isn't so much what alcohol does to us that makes us alcoholics, but it's what alcohol does for us that makes us alcoholics. And I like to think about, I didn't take my first drink until I was a freshman at Yale down in New Haven, where I grew up, which is pretty late in life to be starting. We have people now who have 6 years sobriety when they're freshmen in college, but I was an athlete and was holding off, and the Catholic Church said something about if you don't drink till you're 21, you get 200,000 years off from purgatory or something like that. And I needed all the help I could get in that particular area. So for whatever reason, I didn't start drinking until my freshman year. And I started drinking with this roommate of mine, who was a Jewish fella named Roy, and he lives down in Dallas, Texas these days. And I thought that we had a great similarity. We were always partying, we were always doing this and that. And so as years went by, you know, you don't really get a chance when you're in that young to talk about drinking with people that you started drinking with. So it's only later on that I've had a chance to talk to Roy, and I've spoken in Dallas on numerous occasions, and Roy is hardly an alcoholic. He's just a casual social drinker, even though we both looked like big drinkers back in school. And he has come to AA meetings in Dallas, and he loves them, and just because of what they've done for me. And he just saw how happy my life is and how I got sort of saved. And so he's very grateful once removed and comes to these meetings and gets a big kick out of them. He's sort of an honorary member of Alcoholics Anonymous when I show up in town. But there came a time, I guess, when we were both about 50, and I said to Roy, if you and I started out and there were so many similarities, now you've had a chance to look back and this is 30 years later, you've been drinking for 30 years, If you had to describe alcohol to people, if you just got up and you had a little group and said, tell them what alcohol is, what would you say? So here's this guy that I started drinking with, and he thought it over, and he said, well, he said, one of the biggest things for me, and if you really want to know the truth, is alcohol makes food taste better. It was like a big top priority in his description of alcohol. And I don't think too many of us would have thought of that one as the real reason that we were hanging in there drinking, was it made food taste better. And I remember thinking to myself, I didn't say it, but I was thinking to myself, is that going down or coming up? You know, food tastes better. I mean, you know. And then he went on to say that at the end of the day, he'll come home and it'll be the end of the work day, and he'll mix a little drink and maybe have a few sips out of it and then go take a shower, and it's sort of a transition from the working day to the end of the day. And then he allowed us how on certain times during the year to get a group of people together and we'd have some drinks, and it just made the social contact a little happier, and that was it. And that was his whole description of alcohol. He never said alcohol is the secret of life, which is what I would have said. Because even though we looked alike when we were drinking, looked like we were doing the same thing, alcohol was not doing for him what it was doing for me. Alcohol was fixing something for me, and that's what made me an alcoholic. It was giving me answers. It was solving something. A lot of times we look at alcohol as causing problems. And sure, if we drink enough, it will, and all of that. But it is, the real dynamics is that it is doing for me something very, very important. And for me, it's almost like I could just take the promises out of the ninth step and put them on the vodka bottle. And there was the 12 promises of vodka, you know, and just look at them all. I mean, just look at all of them, you know. With fear of economic insecurity would leave me. You would intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. I mean, how many of us learned how to dance by just drinking? Hey, I didn't know how to dance 10 minutes ago, but look at me now. And how do you ask a girl out on a date? And how do you do this? And if you're tired, how do you finally get to sleep? Just keep drinking, you'll pass out. And if you don't have any energy, how do you get some? Just drink. I look back on it, and I never remember having a problem where I said, here's a problem I won't be drinking over. I mean, problem solving, what was step one to problem solving? Get a drink. God, I can't decide to do this. I can't decide to do that. Well, here's how we decide. Pour it down. Bang. Boy, I had answers. I had access to a perspective that I didn't have. It's like my brain shut down when I didn't have alcohol. I was left frightened. You know what I mean? I think of my sobriety as being a fear-filled type of life. And I just, when fear is in there, we're like an animal's frozen with fear. They can't decide. They can't make a move. And you see them, cars run over them. You know, they're frozen in the headlights. That's what sobriety was for me, was filled with fear. I didn't have access to all of my resources. It was no energy. It just wasn't complete. And alcohol made me feel complete. And I had a different perspective on the world. And I saw the world that other people were talking about. People were talking about, isn't it wonderful, all the love in the world, how marvelous people are? And I'd go to a church and they'd be talking about God and all this wonderful stuff. I never saw any of that. You know what I mean? And I started thinking that the people who were talking about that were lying. You know what I mean? They were just making this up, this wonderful brotherly love and all these feelings and this and that. But boy, when I started drinking, I sure saw that. I don't know if any of you were emotional drinkers. I can remember going into some strange town and going into a bar, you know, and all uptight, and the town looked like it was a very intimidating town, some little Midwestern place, and I'm sort of in this bar, I'll go in and get a drink. Three drinks later, the bartender's coming over, I'm sobbing, his tears are coming, he says, what's the matter? I said, I've never seen such beautiful people as that are in this bar. I've just been overcome by the magnificent, by them all around, I just, Never seen such magnificence. Maybe you've never had that happen, but I remember that, you know. So here was this chemical that just had power to transport me into a world that I loved and take me out of a world that was very intimidating and filled with all these mean people that were out to get me and confusion and so on down. So in a literal sense, alcohol was a higher power for me. It really was a higher power. And I turned my life over to it. Didn't consciously turn it over to it, but I had done a third step on vodka and had turned my will and my life over to the care of vodka. And I really mean that, because drinking was an unknown adventure. I never knew what was going to happen when I drank, but I knew that it wasn't going to be boring. I knew that something would happen. I mean, I never drank and just stood there. You know, hey, what's going on here? I don't relate to people who said, let's get out of this bar, nothing's happening. If nothing was happening, you drink faster. And something would happen. You know, hey, the cops are here, look at that. But alcohol would cause it to happen. You didn't have to go somewhere else. This had the power to produce a world and a whole series of events. And so going into a liquor store and selecting a bottle of booze was, for me, very similar to going into a library and checking out an adventure book. You could get this adventure book, and you could have even read the author before. You could look at it and read the jacket and so on down, but until you took it home and read it, you really didn't know where that book was going to take you. And lo and behold, it's over here, it's there, and it's all this stuff that you were big surprises and all that. That's exactly what alcohol was for me. I could get a bottle of vodka and hold it up to the light in that package store and shake it, and I had no idea what was in store for me. I might be traveling whiskey. End up in Wiggins, Mississippi. You know, you weren't even planning on going down there. Or it could be go-to-jail whiskey. You only got half the bottle down and you're locked up. Or it could be, the one I like was when the Big Blonde showed up. That was my favorite. And I would go back and ask the guy, have you got that one? I go, where was the case? Got a bottle in here last week. It was the most amazing bottle of vodka I've ever had in my life. But there was no way of knowing what you were going to get out of this thing. And taking that kind of risk in drinking, because it was very risky for us to drink, because we really did not know what was going to happen. But it was worth it. I look at it and I think about all the trouble that alcohol caused. And I think this is where our rationalization gets better and better as the years go by. Because in the beginning, there's a small amount of trouble that comes with alcohol. And then as the years go on and the ravages take place and we withdraw and we get more and more of the physical damage, and maybe we're getting fired and marriages are breaking up and relationships and health and all those things, the price is clearly going up. But in my mind, the equation always balanced out. Sure, there's a price to pay, but it's worth it. What I'm getting out of this is clearly worth it. And so that's the relationship that I had with alcohol. Now, the specifics of it were that I was drank in college. I got out of there. It was back in the Korean War, and everybody had to join the military. A bunch of guys were standing around one Saturday, and we were drinking beer, and they said, let's go join the Marine Corps. Oh, Jesus, you know. So I'm with my beer. I'm down there joining the Marine Corps. And, boy, when I got in there, that was quite a surprise. I hate to tell the story myself. They had a brochure about Quantico, Virginia, which is where I went to start the whole thing. And it had pictures of the old club and the golf course. I showed up with my golf clubs, you know what I mean? Just, hi. Hate to tell you where they told me to put the golf clubs. I mean, it's just amazing. But anyway, I ended up in the Marine Corps, and it was awful. I mean, these people were insane. It was winter time, and they would look and they'd wait until it was freezing, and then they'd say, let's sleep out tonight. Go out and dig a hole in the snow and stay there until spring. You know, that kind of, and it was very important to be able to do that, and I just didn't relate to these kind of people. They wanted to kill people and stick throwing knives in their throats and, oh my God, it was just, what am I doing here? And they showed a movie one time, sort of a training film about pilots. Guess where the pilots were? They were in the officers club. And they were talking about like this. And I went, now there, that's what I want. So I signed up for this thing and said, I want to be a pilot. And I'd never been in an airplane. And so I got somehow passed the test and everything and ended up in flight school and got airsick for the first 8 or 10 flights, but got over that and ended up flying for the Marine Corps for 12 years. So that's where I was a practicing alcoholic. That's what I did for my, that's where I got my drinking money. You know, a lot of people made the Marine Corps a career. I made it a hobby. And, but it was very exciting. I got into fighter planes and flew jets and just had a marvelous, exciting time. But the funny thing about that is as the alcoholism progressed, I can remember for a number of years, maybe 5 years, first 5 years that I flew, no matter how screwed up I was mentally with life's problems, as soon as I took off, as soon as those wheels came up, I was totally in the now, flying. You know what I mean? Where you're supposed to be, whatever your job is, I was totally in the now. And I remember somewhere after 5 years or so, that didn't work. Even the excitement of that kind of flying, I was taking up all my problems from the day. I'd be flying around, oh God, I told this lie, I'm going to have to cover this story. You know what I mean? And it was just, and never again was I getting any relief from my conscience. Because I believe there's a part of us that we get in touch with later on that doesn't want any of this to happen. We don't want to be the kind of person that we're becoming. But we can't do anything about it. We're trapped. We're powerless. And there's this tremendous conflict between the good in us. We don't know what that good is at that time. At least I didn't. I just knew there was this, oh, I don't want to be this way. I want to be a better husband. I want to be a better father. I really want to show up on time and do a decent work. But I'm not. And so I got to explain it to myself. And I would come up with all kinds of rationalization that, hey, some of us are just born bad. You know, I should have gotten born bad tattooed on my hand. You know what I mean? So that this would be my attempt to get peace of mind, to resolve this conflict between the part of me that couldn't stand what was going on and the reality of what was going on. So ironically, this is where I think the insanity of the second step comes in. Ironically, in order to resolve this conflict, I was trying to kill the good in me. If I could have traded my soul, I would have peace of mind because there wouldn't be anything in conflict with the way I was living, which is really insane that we would want. But that's the pain. I think that's why alcoholics sometimes think about suicide, is that there's something deep inside of us that just knows there's a better way of living. And we're desperately seeking, but we don't know how we can get there. So anyway, I'm off flying these airplanes, get married, had 6 kids, a big family, and if you were to look at this, you'd say, well, this guy's going along, apparently doing very well. And I'm just totally disintegrating inside. As we know, spirituality is an inside job, and so is alcoholism. It's destroying us from the inside out, and we're trying to pretend that nothing is wrong. I think the hardest part of being an alcoholic is to pretend you're not an alcoholic. You get out of bed and you threw up that morning, you're feeling terrible, you're shaking, you're hurting, but you walk out and people say, Mary, how you doing? Fine! You gotta tell them you're fine or they'll get in there. You can't let them know that you're almost gonna die or they're gonna get in your face, they're gonna find out what it is and somebody is gonna say, you ought to stop drinking. And that's the ultimate threat. Somebody getting inside and going, you shouldn't be drinking. I mean, that terrified me. I only had it happen once in the years that I was drinking. I was in a fighter squadron with this major. He and I drank together all the time. And I thought he was as big an alcoholic as I was. And we were getting ready to go aboard the carrier, and we were standing out at the end of the runway where you practice these landings, and we were watching some of the other guys fly. And just shooting the breeze on the end of the runway, talking about this. And he started saying, boy, someday I want to have my own squadron. And he was a major, so he was qualified. He was the maintenance officer. He would have one soon. And I said, oh, that'd be great. I'd love to be in your outfit. And he said, I'd love to have a whole squadron of pilots like you. I just love the way you fly. I'm just feeling real good, you know. He's recognized I'm doing. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I couldn't believe those words. But I wouldn't let you drink. And I just let it slide. I didn't ask him. I didn't do a thing, but I can still feel it to this day, what it felt like to have somebody know my number and just have it and say it right up front. The next time I had people telling me stuff up front like that was in AA, where we just talked to each other. You know what I mean? Like, I know, but we had a big AA guy in Washington, D.C. named Buck Doyle. And his, you know how sometimes if there's somebody comes to the meeting, they've been drinking a little bit, and there's a tendency, did I really smell anything or not? You know what I mean? You might cut a little slack and a little slide a little bit. Not Buck. Not Buck. He'd walk right up and go, hey, one of us has been drinking. And I don't think it's me. And just boom. And that is what we should be doing. We really should be dealing in the truths and saying right what's there. But anyway, that wasn't existing out in the real life. Especially back in the 60s when the country and the Marine Corps and anybody else didn't know how to deal with alcoholism. They just waited. I talked to a lot of commanding officers of the Marine Corps, and they said, well, if I had an alcoholic in my unit, I would just wait till we transferred him. And then it was somebody else's problem, you know, because you only worked there for a year, and then you were shipped off somewhere else. So I went along in this way, and eventually the end of the line came for me in 1964, and I was flying out of Cherry Point, North Carolina, and I was just, I could barely fly. I mean, I would get in the plane, and I would have withdrawals. I didn't realize what I should have been doing was taking booze up in the plane, which is what a lot of other guys have told me about, and they lasted longer. But I would not drink for like 12 hours, and then I'd have the shakes and withdrawal symptoms. I'd lose my vision, sweating, a heart palpitation, all these terrifying things in the airplane was just pure alcoholic withdrawal. And eventually it got so bad, one flight I flew around with my hand on the ejection seat because I thought I was going to pass out. And passing out from alcoholic withdrawal is not in the pilot's handbook. They don't even, it's never assumed that this problem's going to arise, so why would you put it in the, if you've been drinking too much and you're flying this high-performance jet, we suggest, you know, so us alcoholics are always running into problems that society hasn't prepared answers for. You know what I mean? Like, what do you say to someone when you puke on them at a cocktail party? It's just not an Emily Post anywhere, but all of us have had to come up with how you deal with those kind of situations. We've had to deal with things that most people just don't have to deal with. And so my answer to passing out was to put your hand and get a death grip on it. And then I figured if you passed out, you fall forward, boom, the seat fires out and the chute opens automatically. And hey, problem solved. You know what I mean? What's the next problem? It wasn't that I should do anything about my drinking or my way of life or anything like that. It was just, hey, I love the way I just deal with these things as they come along. But I just finally went to the doctor. I mean, and that started the whole thing. What? You're doing what? And these airplanes and this and that. And I went off to, I was sent down to Pensacola, Florida. 2 weeks, doctors examining me under a microscope every day. Every night I'm getting drunk. I'm coming back. I remember the dentist one time. They checked everything. What could be causing this guy to have these terrible symptoms in airplane? And the dentist is going, God, you reek of alcohol. And I said, yeah, I've been drinking. Oh. You know what I mean? It was just boom. And at the end of the 2 weeks, all kinds of psychiatric tests, physical tests. What is causing this guy to have his hand shake, his sweats all the time, his eyes are red and blurry, his speech is slurred. When he flies airplanes, he gets all freaked out. What is it? Well, you know what I mean? It was this huge write-up, and nobody could figure it out. There was no explanation for that. And so the psychiatrist wrote it up, and this is the truth. My diagnosis was childhood fear of flying. That was this guy's problem. Because at that point, they didn't have, alcoholism was not a diagnosis that anybody in the Navy or the Marine Corps had. It was not in the books. You always were in the hospital for some other reason. And so I was sent back to Cherry Point, and I was waiting for orders. No, you can't fly anymore, but we're going to give you a new job. And guess what? I was reassigned. Guy that can't fly, he's in such terrible shape. I became an air traffic controller. And I brought planes in bad weather when they couldn't see the runway. So now they put the other guy's life at risk. But that was the end of, that was my last year drinking, and I didn't have any horror stories. Most of the people that worked for me did the actual work, and I was overseas, and they would go, "Captain, let me tell you," this was the master sergeant in charge of, really in charge of the unit. He'd go, "Captain, your job is to try and find the unit every morning. And then we'll cover for you all day, and you'll be all right." And that was my job, was to get on my bicycle and try and find the unit, you know, on the base, and just be drunk. And it was an awful year. I lost about 50 pounds, malnutrition. I mean, we're talking about just daily drinking, vodka, grain alcohol, total withdrawal. I stopped eating with people because my hands were shaking so bad I couldn't use utensils. I'd just eat, you know, sandwiches or something like that, and just drinking and totally isolating and freaking out and all that kind of stuff. And was sent back to the States. Now I'm ready to enter AA. I didn't realize I'm about to enter AA. I'm coming back to Quantico, Virginia, to go through a career school to become the next general, you know what I mean, moving up in the ranks. And at this school, I had a grand mal seizure, you know, where you stand up and bite your tongue and down you go. And that finally caused people to say, "This guy has something wrong with him." And I was sent off to Bethesda Naval Hospital to see what it was. They examined me for about 3 days. "What? This guy must be studying too hard. He had a seizure down there, like an epileptic seizure or something. Still no alcohol." And, of course, now I haven't had a drink in 3 days, and I went into the DTs. And that explained everything, and I was in a straitjacket, and now I'm locked up in the nut ward. And I was locked up for 6 months. I mean, because there was no alcohol program. You're just thrown in to a nut ward. A psychiatric nut ward. And there was about four drunks in there, and all the rest of the people had everything. You know what I mean? Schizophrenic, manic depressive, all of the various mental illnesses. And we get up and we go to group therapy in the morning with all the other people, and go to clay class and go basketball. And after a while you get used to that. You kind of like it. You know what I mean? It's a very safe environment, and you just, "Hey, I like it in here." You know, you have no responsibility. They give you a lot of drugs and you're going around. The main event of the day was making a cup of tea. "How do you like your tea?" "Oh, boy, that's a cup of tea, I'll tell you, you know." Because you had to feel useful. And ashtrays, you know, making ashtrays aren't going to do it. So, but there was this environment, you know. There was no real treatment for alcoholism. And the local AA had been in to Bethesda in the early 60s, and the psychiatrist had determined that it wasn't doing any good. People were getting sober, but that didn't matter. So they stopped AA. And fortunately, in this particular moment, in December of 1964, the local AA had talked the psychiatrist into allowing some tentative meetings in this institute. And that's how I got to AA. I was in the nut ward, been there about 4 months. And a corpsman came in and said, "All drunks, fall in." We're out into the elevator, down, and I'm at an AA meeting. And that's where I heard my first meeting. But I was not relating to my problem being alcohol. And so I went up to the guy who brought the meeting. I was very impressed with him, a little redheaded guy. And I said, "You know, you got a great..." I was so impressed with all this stuff. And I told him, "If I ever run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him around here. I think this is just wonderful. Just not, it's not me." And he said something about, "Hey, pal, let me ask you a question. Which one of us is going home and the car and his family and all that, and which one of us is going over there and get locked up like an animal?" And I remember feeling real bad about that. I didn't like that reality coming on too fast. You know, you're supposed to gradually bring reality into the picture. And so we went to some of those for about 2 months, and then I was let out as an outpatient. I immediately started drinking and got in terrible shape in a matter of 2 days. Knew I was in trouble, that I was going to be thrown out of the Marine Corps, And I called AA on my own, outside, over a weekend. And this big guy came over to my house, who's now my sponsor, and he was a Marine captain. And my name is Bill, this is a 12-step call, I talk, you listen. That was the basic relationship. A huge guy, you know, big, head-shaved head. And I just went, ooh, I better do what he says, then I'll get rid of him. And then, but I've never been able to get rid of him, you know. It was just get in the car, sit in the front row. If you need an opinion, I'll give you one. Shut up. I don't want to hear anything, you know, in your opinion. Who the hell wants your opinion? Anytime, you know, I'd go, hey, I went to Yale. I got all, you know, I got some ideas, guys. I think there's too many steps here in AA. I've been studying the book, and they'd just go, why would we listen to you? You're wearing a goddamn wristband from a nut. Goddamn. I mean, I was an outpatient for like 5 more months, and I'd be speaking at meetings, and I'd get that wristband up under the thing there because I knew that people didn't listen to people with wristbands. You know what I mean? They just disqualified. I don't care how good you sound. The results of your life are not something that we are after. And I have found this very effective with new people in AA. As brilliant as they may be, we just focus on the results of their life. Not the theory, not their ideas about life, but the actual results. You know, like, hey, you have no friends. People at work hate you. Your family won't talk to you. You puke a lot and you stink. But you're real smart. But I'm not following you. I don't want to hear your ideas. If you write them down, I'm not going to read them. Because they're getting lousy results. And you know, that's what AA is. It's totally result-oriented. No theory, just results. That's why we say, if you want what we have, here's how you get there. If you want what we have. This is a big show-and-tell operation. First it's a lost and found, and it's a big show-and-tell. You know what I mean? You want to see what sobriety looks like. You want to look at somebody who's working the steps. You want to hear whether they were like, so that we just get up and tell you, all right, I was locked up in the nut ward. I did this, and now I'm doing this. Now I got a great job. I'm down in Washington. I'm a lobbyist. I make a lot of money. I go on vacations, but mostly I love AA, and I do a lot of AA, what do I like about AA? So now I can shift stories. I think I've qualified. I think I have established myself as a person who had some degree of problem with alcohol. And I got to hear AA, and I got this sponsor, and he started me down a journey it's a entirely different journey than that drinking journey was. But there's a lot of similarities. There really are. We were on to the right thing when we decided that life was too much for us and we couldn't make it on our own and we resorted to alcohol. We were on, that was correct. That was a correct assumption. That life is too much for us and you cannot make it through on our own. I think this is a true statement for all human beings. That the deal is, you've got to find something in addition to yourself. I think that is the greatest lesson I've learned out of here, is that it's not set up that you're supposed to be able to make it by yourself, totally on your own resources. And that is a very major lesson about life. And us alcoholics must have found it early on because we found alcohol to take care of that, which was the right thing to do. It was the wrong higher power. That was the only problem. We needed a power greater than ourselves like vodka. And it apparently worked for a while, but it was the wrong higher power. And we come in here and it is so essential to surrender, and I think that's what's the wonderful thing about those of you that are new. Sometimes you hear a spiritual program, you just go, I'm not into that. I don't want religion. I don't need any of that. But then you got to stick around a while and give us a chance to talk about this, because it has nothing to do with religion. It doesn't have anything to do with religion. Religion starts off by telling you who this higher power is. That's the first step. Let me tell you about Muhammad. Let me tell you about Christ. Let me tell you about Buddha. And here's all the books and study, and then you'll all know about Buddha, whatever it is. AA doesn't deal with that. There is no AA God. When you think about it, AA does not try to convince anybody of the existence of God. But I'll tell you what we're very good at. Convincing you of the need for it. That's our specialty. Is showing you in our first step that unless there's such a thing as some power, you're dog meat. That's our first step. That's where you are. And I love to use this little analogy because it's not an intellectual process getting spiritual. It's not an intellectual process. It works something like this. Imagine, if you will, that we have a special way of introducing you to steps 1 and 2, and I'm going to be able to borrow some of those marine airplanes in order to do it. And this is what the first and second step look like. We go, look, you got to understand powerlessness, so we're going on a powerlessness training flight. Now that the cop has sent you to AA or however you got here. You know, we don't look upon those people who sent us here as messengers from God. Hey, pull over and breathe in here. That doesn't look like a spiritual moment in our lives. But we should go back and thank that guy, you know what I mean? And find him and hug him and just go, God, you selected me out of everybody in hell to let me out. But it doesn't look like that. And once you enter this realm, nothing looks like it is. Because we're moving from the material world to the spiritual world with all the paradoxes in here. And it's very deceptive. AA meetings don't look like they should work. Did you ever go to your friends after you've been in AA a while and they say, geez, you look wonderful, Marcia. You look wonderful, Joe. What the hell's going on? Well, I joined AA. Well, what do you do there? Well, we go down into a basement at 8:30 at night. Maybe about 25 of us, and we get some coffee and cigarettes, and we sit around a table, and a guy comes up with a topic, maybe resentment. Okay, resentment. And then we go all the way around the table, then we go home. And I see, and that makes you feel wonderful. Oh, yeah, you want to come with me? I'd be glad to show you down there. Doesn't look like it should work. Does not look like it should work. And I'm sure the first time you looked at 12 steps, they didn't look like they would work. I remember looking at him, I said, hey, where's the step where you get a $2,000 loan? That was top priority. You know what I mean? We can get spiritual later on, but I got to get these guys off my back. I got to pay this and that. And I didn't see anything in there that was solving my immediate problems. And so I didn't connect that this was the most miraculous answer I was ever going to run into. So getting back to taking the first and second step, taking you on your AA training flight, it would work something like this. We take you up and say, get in there. I'm going to let you sit in the front seat, and I'm going to fly from the back and just sit back and just have a wonderful flight. And it'll take you up to about 55,000 feet so you can really see the world in its total perspective. And while you're sitting there really enjoying it, little surprise, we blow the canopy open, roll the plane upside down, pull some negative G's, and you go out. And you have no chute. And but with a little intercom radio still working, I said, hey, you're getting the feeling of powerlessness out there. Is it registering at all? And this is when we just go, yeah. You know, and you kind of think, hey, this guy's probably somehow going to get me back in that plane. But we don't. We just let you fall and fall. And maybe you're a cool guy for the first 20,000 feet. You're doing like a skydiver, you know. Hey, something's going to happen. But nothing does. And we're just going to, you get the sense of powerlessness. You see what power, yeah, I'm seeing it. But you don't really see it till you get down around 2,000 feet when relative motion starts taking over. Now, the ground, which was way out there for about 2 minutes, because it takes a long time to fall from 50,000 feet, suddenly it's going, whoo, like fast. Everything's getting big. And you see a parking lot, and you see a truck. And you see, hey, I'm going to hit the truck. You know, like, whoa. And about 8 feet from the truck, a big hand comes down and goes, rah! Last second, just grabs you. And a voice says, excuse me, we're taking a survey here. Do you believe in God? Now, my point is, your answer to that question under those circumstances is liable to be entirely different than if we asked you at a bar some night. Say, what are your feelings about, oh shit, you buying any of that crap? Religions have done more damage in the world than anything else. Right around, off you go, proving that this or that and whatever it is that you've got all these wonderful ideas. None of those are going to be too relevant at this moment we're about to hit. And that's what being powerless over alcohol means. Means powerless. Means we're going to smash. We're going to hit the alcoholic bottom of insanity or death, some terrible disease as it gets into our liver. I mean, alcoholic deaths are awful. That's what being powerless is. And the only answer to that is a higher power. And so when we get to that thing, the answer is in the second step, no, I don't, but I'm willing to reconsider. And that's all it takes. You want to become spiritual? All you do is reconsider. Well, I'm willing to have an open mind. And the open mind that comes about from powerlessness in each one of our stories, and each one of us has our own story of what gave us an open mind. And basically, you know what gave us an open mind? Drinking gave us an open mind. Drinking took our elbow behind, you know how you hold a guy's hand back here and you go, say uncle, no, no. That's us. That's what drinking was doing. You gonna say it yet? No, no. And finally you just get, okay, I'm powerless, I give up. Now you give up. Now the door is open. Because I believe that alcoholism is a self-centered prison. We just drive ourselves inward into total isolation. We've been given the power to block God. We can block everything, including God. We can prevent a higher power from flowing through us. The same way we can prevent the love of our family from reaching us. I used to call the love of my family meddling. Why do they keep calling me up all the time? Jesus Christ, they're harassing me. I didn't recognize it. It was they loved me, and they were concerned, and they just wanted to somehow reach out. But bam, they weren't going to get in here. Nobody's going to get in. And if you're new, you can prove that AA doesn't work if you want, because you have the power to prevent AA from working. You just go, and you can't get in because you've been given the power to block it out. But let me just tell you that if you do this, you haven't proved that AA doesn't work. You may think you have, much like you've proved that there was no God, never got in here, there's no love, there isn't any of this. All we've proved is we're stupid. That's all we've proved. Hey, I had a chance for a wonderful life. Get out of this hell. Stop puking every day. You know what I did? I told them to screw off. I told them to bug off. What do you think of that? You know, and we think they're going to write a song about us. You know, like, what a damn guy. Boy, there's guts. I mean, we really see this. Boy, isn't that incredible what I did? I defied him and I did all that. And people are going, what an asshole. That's what they're saying. They're not writing a song about us. They didn't write any, you know, they just, and that's it. Bill uses that word, stupid. You see throughout our literature, he says, we're especially stupid in this area. We're especially stupid here. It's not a complex Freudian problem. It's just stupid. Here was a good deal. Here was a bad deal. Hey, give me the bad deal. Ha, ha, ha. And so not choosing a higher power is stupid. It's just, but you see, our ego likes the idea of not choosing a higher power. I did it alone. I did it my way. If I was still drinking, I love that song, I did it my way. You know, I forget how the guy's in jail and he's got all these problems. But, ha, 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 I did it my way. Sort of shake your fist and just defy and all that, because you want to be able to have done it alone. And here's this wonderful experience. So I finally, you know, the ego got crushed and I surrendered. And my sponsor had the best way of explaining to me a higher power. He said, why don't you turn your life over to whatever will take it? End of discussion. We don't have to know who's going to take it or any of that stuff. A gorilla in the zoo with a dartboard would make better decisions about your life than you've been making. The reason for turning your life over is to remove the management of your life from the hands of an idiot. That's what is being done. That's the big thing that needs to be done right now. Forget what's going to happen. Anything that happens is going to be better than what you have been able to achieve. And, you know, you have to look at this and you just go, record, results, results. What results have you been getting? Look at what AA's been getting. Hey, so we really don't turn it over. We get to be the judge of the results. And that's all that we do. And that's what we report on year after year. Hi, I'm here after 10 years to report wonderful results. Thank you very much. And sit down. That's what sobriety is. We report on, and that's what you get to do. You turn it over. We follow this journey. And this journey is basically the straight and narrow. You ever hear the straight and narrow? I heard about it when I was growing up, and I just said, the straight and narrow, that's boring. I do not want to go down the straight and narrow. I remember that. It's kind of like these steps. There's nothing new in the steps. There's nothing new in AA at all. All these principles have been borrowed from religions, philosophies, and the early experience of the fellowship. But it works. That's the amazing thing. It works wonderfully. And I think that my reluctance in following it was, I don't get to be creative. I don't get to figure stuff out, you know, and I want to inject my own solutions to things. But it isn't solution. What I'm trying to do here is to get power. Always, I think I have to remember, wait a minute, it's got nothing to do with figuring anything out. It's getting to do with not having the wherewithal. Life becomes too much for us. It isn't that we can't figure it out. We just don't have anything left to deal with this. I sometimes compare spirituality, which is totally free, it's invisible, but you recognize it when it's there, with air in a tire. The most expensive tire you can buy still needs free air, just like the retread. And you take the $350 tire when the air runs out, gives you a terrible ride. And the retread with air in it gives you a nice ride. So the most important thing about a tire is air. And it leaks out. You ever get a slow leak in your tire and you go, hey, I'll get that tomorrow. It looks like it's going to lend. We don't go fill it immediately. And if you have my luck, as it gets down real low, that's the day you hit the rut of all ruts, and the rim cuts the tire from the inside out. And in AA spirituality, we would call that a slip. The resources weren't there. The cushion was not there to deal with the realities of life that day, and it cut through. And so we come in here and we go, all I need to do, and we talk about this in our 10th step, daily reprieve, contingent on our spiritual condition. All I got to remember is my basic problem is not what I think it is. Whatever you would say your problem is, the problem is powerlessness. Anytime you say, well, my work situation is just overpowering me. It's just too much for me. Do you ever say that about your work? It's too much for me to deal at work. That's right. You need more power. You need more wherewithal. And when we get that, that's why when we go to a meeting, we're so frustrated at the end of a day. Everything has just overwhelmed us. And we come into the meeting. About 45 minutes into the meeting, we just feel comfortable about life. And the situation isn't as bad as we thought it was when we walked in. Because we've been pumped up. We've had, whether we recognize it or not, we've had the spirituality of the other people in the room just come in. And we became open to this. We're not open to spirituality normally. We have to make a conscious effort to read a book or to do something along those lines. 24-hour day book, whatever it is, or prayer. In order to bring in and have this 10-second cushion. You know, the Bible talks about wearing life as a loose garment. A loose garment, to me, means having 10 seconds between me and the world. A 10-second cushion between you insulting me and me having to react to that. Because when there's no cushion, your boss comes up and he says, this report stinks. And we go, I quit. And we, you know what I mean? Because nobody talks to me that way. And the I quit is just on the way to his ears, and we want to get it back. Because this is the wrong time to not have a job. But we didn't have any protection. We had nothing between us and the world. And we're just vulnerable to everything. It's like the thin skin. Everything that happens hurts me, the self-centeredness. And here's what I think happens in A, what we get with spirituality, is a cushion. That's what drinking did. Three drinks, I had a cushion. You remember that wonderful feeling of, hey, everything looks all right now. You know, I can deal with reality now. Hey, this is the way it ought to be. That's exactly what I believe happens in here. But more than that happens, I'm going to look at my watch and decide. I got about 5 more minutes. Let me wrap up with this. For those of you that may be new, when we first come to AA, all we want to do is not drink. We figured that's all I need to do. And if you have a sponsor like I do, he goes, okay, you got to stop drinking, but I also think you ought to stop embezzling. I mean, we don't have a thing in here that says no embezzling. This is not Embezzlers Anonymous or anything. But my experience has been, it's real hard to stay sober and embezzle. All right. I'm going to stop. I'll put some of the money back, and I'm going, you know, okay. Well, that's about it. Then he gets you over. Look, if you want to try and live a nice, sober life, and you want to have your marriage hold together, I think you ought to stop having all those affairs. You know, what are you getting in my face on everything? You know, you're trying to make a saint out of it. No, it's just been my experience. Real hard to stay sober and have a regular life if you're embezzling and having a lot of affairs. You know, it's not that we're totally against it. I'm just giving you a little thing, you know. So now I'm giving up affairs, embezzling, and drinking. And every time you turn around, he's got one more thing. You know what I mean? One more. You know, what about this? What about that? It turns out AA is a two-step program. All you have to do, don't drink and change everything there is about you. And that's what I mean by that. Let me just tell you what I think spirituality is. Every one of us in this room is such a remarkably beautiful, perfect person that we were right when we had those three drinks and became overpowered by the beauty in the room. Maybe we were actually able to see the real beauty of every one of you. But our ideas appear. Old ideas, chapter 5, availed us nothing. Those ideas are not the truth. And they have to be gotten rid of. So this process of growing is almost a misnomer. Because all we're doing is getting rid of things. Sobriety is like a balloon ride. You know how you get a better view in a balloon? You throw away things. Throw more shit overboard. And the balloon goes higher. And you get a better view. And so you want life to look better. What more can I get rid of? In the beginning, we fight this. I got to give up what? Give up that? You know, Jesus, next I have to give up fixing parking tickets. You know what I mean? Give up that? And then we find out there's a direct correlation between getting rid of and the view improving. And we start seeing the reality of this journey that we're on. And the journey is towards ourselves, because all we want to do is be able to see our true nature and to understand how beautiful and magnificent you are. And the way I describe sobriety, the best way I've been able to describe it, I heard a sculptor say this one time. He was asked, how do you get this beautiful woman? I mean, it's just magnificent. And he said, well, you just start with a big rock and you get rid of all the stuff that isn't beautiful. And that's what we do in here. We just get rid of everything that isn't beautiful. And it's a magnificent journey. You get the biggest present you get, if you're brand new to AA, is you. We hand you this present, and it's you, and your job is to unwrap it. And that's what the steps do. They go, no, that's just wrapping. Get rid of that. That's not you. That's not you. And one day, the real brilliance of your true being starts shining through. Other people, now I'll tell you where you're going to see it. Let me just detour for 5 more minutes, because this is, I know you'll relate to this. You're going to see a glimpse of what we're talking about at about 2 or 3 months, and you're no longer the newest person in the group. But you're not joining in, you're not really helping out or anything, you know, because you don't want to rush into this. You're still sort of observing, if you know what I mean. You like being sober, but you're not totally buying into these people have gone over the hill. They're so fanatic about all this. But you're sitting there one night at a discussion meeting, and a new guy comes in about 5 minutes late. And you can just look at him, and you can remember where you were 3 months ago. Is the fear in his eyes. It's just, you know, he's very unsure of where, and well, I guess I'll sit over there. And he goes up to get some coffee, and he starts to get it, and his hand shakes so bad that he puts it down and hopes that no one saw him trying to get the coffee. His face turns a little red, and he comes over and sits down. And without you knowing it, your heart just goes, goes over there. You don't actually go talk to him, but your heart went over there, and you just go, God, I hope he comes back next week. Boy, I hope he comes. You don't even know his name. And you hope he comes back next week. And when he comes back next week, and maybe he's not there when the meeting starts, and he does come in, and just inside, you don't want anybody to see this, you go, yay. Yay. And you're cheering for somebody else. First time you've ever cheered for anybody else. You know what I mean? Really cheered. Well, who's cheering? What is that in you that's cheering? What is this that is suddenly delighted in the well-being of somebody else? That must be a rather magnificent part of you. And this is what gets unwrapped. That is what we go after. That's what the program goes after. It just becomes so that someday you recognize this is the fundamental you. A tremendously loving and caring and happy and excited creature. And life becomes just a very different event. And we look back and we go, I just came here to get sober, and I've been taken down a journey that I didn't even know existed. The things that we get in sobriety, we didn't know, we would never have been able to ask for because we didn't know they existed. I want 2 yachts. I want a big blonde. I want, you know, all those things. And we get handed instead a reality that is far beyond our wildest dreams of being able to see the earth and all its beauty, being able to see. Chuck Chamberlain's book, A New Pair of Glasses, just talks about that. That's what sobriety is. It's like somebody handing us a pair of glasses where everything is just magnificent. And I believe this to be an absolute truth. Everything is perfect right now. When we talk about, I don't know how many of you, are you going, well, I'm not doing too good now, but I got a real great date 2 weeks from now, and then I'm going to have one of those great days. Or I'll be on vacation, and then I'll have... And the reality is, everything's just perfect right now. We just got to learn how to see it that way. And to me, that's what you're going to get. That's exactly what these steps are designed to enable you to do. And if you're new, I want to be around when you get unwrapped and get up here and start telling everybody the same story, because it is the same story over and over. We were lost and now we're found, and I'm delighted to be amongst you, and I hope we all continue to have a wonderful journey together, and thanks for inviting me.